أشهد أن لا إله إلا الله أشهد أن لا إله إلا الله أشهد أن محمد رسول الله أشهد أن محمد
السلام عليكم. Peace be unto you. We're back for another episode of Islam in Focus. We're continuing with our series dealing with the sources of Islam. And today we'll be having the second program dealing with the topic of the Bible as a possible source of the Quran. I'm your host, Hani Rashid, and I have joining me on the program, as usual, Dr. Jamal Battery of St. Mary's University. Brother Jamal, assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam.
This is a very fascinating question, the Bible as a possible source of the Quran. Mm-hmm. Could I perhaps have you summarize very quickly the main points that we touched on last week when we began our discussion on this this question?
Certainly. As you mentioned, Brother Hamid, the main theme really of this discussion is the examination of the statement which is made quite frequently, but unfortunately it's not very correct, that because the Quran was revealed after the Bible, then the Quran must have borrowed from the Bible and anything that's similar. And in the previous program, we discussed two basic areas. One is the conception of God in both books, or conception of Allah. And we indicated that there are some important differences which shows that the Quran could have never really been based on the Bible. From the analytical, strictly analytical point of view, we talked about the anthropomorphism, or the way the Bible sometimes depicts God in a sort of superhuman form, that he has an image, he walks and makes sound when he walks, that he takes rest, that he sometimes forgets, that he doesn't know what is going to happen, and that's why he regrets some of his decisions, that he at times fears the competition of the power of humans, as in the story of the Tower of Babel. Many times he's referred to in a sort of tribal meaning, like the God of Israel, as if he were a tribal type of God. And in some cases, as we discussed, even the human could even prevail over him, like his story with Jacob. And we indicated that in contrast to this, we find the Quran, while emphasizing on the nearness of God and his intimate relationship with the pious, we still find a great deal of emphasis on the transcendence of God. We don't see any notion at all of God being physical or materialized or reincarnate in some form or the other. And all of these descriptions that you find in the Bible are totally absent in the Quran. Always the Quran speaks of him as the Lord of the universe. The second main question was the question of prophethood. And we indicated again that while there may be some similarity on the surface of the concept of prophets and revelation between the Bible and the Quran, it was clear from the various documentation and references made to the Bible that the conception or perception of prophets in the Bible is quite different, that many times great prophets, well-known figures, are accused of compromising in the matter of faith. Like, for example, Solomon and Aaron. Other prophets have been accused of major moral sins. In contrast to that, we have seen again how the Quran emphasizes a great deal about the holiness of those individuals, that while they were humans, they were the best models of humans. So in both items that were discussed, it was quite obvious that there is no ground really to say that the Quran was influenced, quote-unquote, or borrowed from the Bible, or else at least some of these notions that we find amply mentioned in the Bible would have crept and affected the content of the Quran.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'd like to move now to an examination of another comparative aspect, and that is with respect to the question of sin and atonement. Some people claim that the story of Adam and Eve in the Bible and the Quran is nearly identical. How would you respond to a position to a person who held that position?
Well, it's basically the same also, like some people, for example, refer to the concept of one God and say, all right, you know, it's basically the same. Mm-hmm. And we have seen by further analysis that yes. It may not be as simple as it may sound on the surface. First of all, to start from the points that are similar, or the common ground, if you will, the only thing that you can say that is nearly identical, nearly, between the Quran and the Bible, is that they were the first creatures, the first human beings, Adam and Eve, that they were in the garden, that they were allowed to eat from any tree except for one tree, I'm not specifying, I'm talking about the common one, one specific tree that they were forbidden, that somehow they succumbed and they ate from that tree, and then they were sent to earth where they were supposed to really live. That much, perhaps, you can say, all right, is common. But beyond the surface, we'll find that there are four important differences, which are not minor, in my opinion. First of all, in the Bible, in the second book of Genesis, we are told that this was a tree of knowledge, as we mentioned in the previous program.
Mm-hmm.
In the Quran, however, there is no such mention of a tree of knowledge. Indeed, there are many citations in the Quran which indicate that it was not really a tree of knowledge. Because, for example, in 91, verse 8, chapter 91 in the Quran, it shows that when God or Allah created the human, He inspired into that human the knowledge of good and evil, of the right from wrong. So according to the way the Quran presents the story of the creation of the humans, the symbol of the human being created from clay is but a clear indication that humans know from their instinctive or innate nature how to distinguish between right and wrong. And as such, they don't need really a tree to eat from in order to arrive at this type of knowledge. A second difference is that in the Bible also we find that the woman seemed to be the one who carries the burden of that first mistake. For example, in Genesis chapter 3, verses 12 through 16, we are told that it was mainly Eve who tempted Adam and somehow persuaded him to eat from that tree. The same verses indicate that as a result of this, God decided to multiply her sorrow through pregnancy and childbirth. And by the way, this is the same meaning or notion that was emphasized in the New Testament also by Paul in his 2 Timothy chapter 2, when he also seemed to repeat the same kind of notion. That's as far as the Bible goes. Again, when you go to the Quran, despite of the similarity on the surface that you mentioned earlier in terms of the basic elements of the story or some basic elements, we find that there is no single citation or passage in the Quran that seems to imply in any way, shape or form that woman alone carries the burden of that or even the primary burden for that first mistake or infraction committed by first humans. Indeed, the Quran always speaks about both of them as being responsible, like in for example, in chapter 2, verses 121 on.
Mm-hmm.
And in one verse, even it points the finger to Adam. Not that he's alone, but points the finger to Adam, which shows that there's no sort of orientation towards woman being blamed for it. On the other hand, if you compare, for example, in Genesis 3, where woman suffering through childbirth and pregnancy is a sort of consequence of that mistake, we find the concept in the Quran is quite different. In fact, pregnancy and childbirth is described in the Quran as something which is very noble, very praiseworthy, something which makes the mother entitled to love, affection, respect,
mm-hmm.
and compassion, as we find, for example, in chapter 29, verse 8 in the Quran, 46, 15, and there are numerous. You might recall many more details on this particular issue were given in the a series on social system in Islam, the part that deals with the woman as depicted in Judeo-Christian and Muslim scriptures or holy books. A third major difference also is that in the book of Genesis, chapter 3, we are told that Eve, in turn, was tempted by the serpent. And again, in the Quran, there is absolutely no mention of the serpent being responsible to whisper to Eve to eat from that forbidden tree. We have discussed in the programs I cited in Social System the origin of this mythology about the serpent being the symbol of evil. In fact, as opposed to that, we find that the Quran in chapter 2 speaks about Satan tempting both Adam and Eve, rather than a serpent tempting Eve and Eve tempting Adam. It talks about the Satan trying to persuade them to disobey God by whatever promises that he gave them, and description which might have not necessarily been true. A fourth, and perhaps the most important of all of these differences, is that after Adam and Eve ate from that tree, there is no mention whatsoever that I have seen in the book of Genesis, for example, in the Bible, about Adam and Eve repenting to God and asking for forgiveness. And this is something that the Quran emphasizes very strongly, that they realized their mistake, they went to pray to Allah or God, they asked for forgiveness, Allah knowing their weakness, because He created them and He knows their weakness, and noting their sincerity and, you know, regret of their mistake, and being merciful creator also, He forgave them. You find that, I'll just give references for the shortness of time, of course any viewer can check that for his own, in the Quran, in chapter 2, verses 37, 122, in chapter 7, verse 23, we find, you know, explanation of this whole notion, which is totally absent in the Bible. So, in the basis of these four comparisons, it appears to me that the story of Adam and Eve in both scriptures is not really as nearly identical as some people may think of it, and I think the differences are important ones.
Mm-hmm. Well, you've characterized these differences as being major, as being important. Why do you consider them to be major differences as opposed to minor differences, as might be suggested by others?
Well, I consider them to be major differences because some of these have important theological implications. In other words, they have some impact on the way the person believes the creeds themselves.
Mm-hmm.
For example, take the issue of the type of the tree. And of course, somebody might say, all right, what difference does it make whether it was this tree or that? Mm-hmm. There was disobedience. But I think it has one more significance than what may appear on the surface. It raises the question as to whether Adam was in fact perfect before he ate from that tree, and then as a result from eating from that tree, he lost that perfection and his essential nature was changed. That is the biblical version. Or is it, as the Quran depicted or presented, that the human is created partially from clay, so he has this material or human nature, he's subject to temptation, and because he's subject to temptation, he succumbed by eating from the tree, so the eating from that tree actually was a result from his nature,
mm-hmm.
and not the reverse. So there's an important implication here.
Yes.
See? A second question is, which related to the first one, is whether a human would have to attain perfection, quote-unquote, to be perfect before he can achieve salvation and felicity in the here or hereafter and come back to paradise as a precondition for salvation, as might be implied from the biblical version, at least as interpreted by Christian theologians, or whether Allah, or God, capital G, knowing the weakness of the human and being just God, does not require human beings anything more than they can. And if it is, by definition, impossible for any human being, no matter what, to be perfect, then how could Allah expect anyone to be perfect? And as the Quran depicted, that if a person makes a mistake and tries to correct that mistake, to come back and repent, that Allah will accept him. So Allah expects us to have lapses on the way, but it depends on whether we are trying or not. And that's a major creedal difference. Thirdly, it raises a question also as to whether the human inherits sin which is committed by his or her ancestors. Is every child born with the stigma of the sin that was committed by Adam and Eve, as might be somehow interpreted from the biblical version? Or is it as the Quran presented, that every child is born innocent and pure, that no inheritance of sin, that nobody can carry the sin of any other person, and that each person is responsible for his or her own behavior and the way the person tried to relate to his creator, as we find amply documented in the Quran, for example, in chapter 17, verse 113, in 53, 38, and others, where there's emphasis on that question of individual responsibility for one's own sin, but not something inherited.
Mm-hmm.
A fourth point, which is perhaps even more important, is whether, as a result of this original sin, in terms of the biblical understanding or biblical interpretation, there must be bloodshed before forgiveness take place, which of course, as you know, is the basis of the whole notion of God becoming man and having to have his blood shed in order to reconcile himself to mankind, or mankind reconcile himself themselves to him. Or whether, according to the Islamic version of it, that God does not really need to become man, or does not require bloodshed in order to forgive, and that if a person really repents, he will find not only acceptance but warm welcome. And just for the sake of those who might wish to research that topic any further, just to mention and listing the number of verses, if I may. In, for example, in 4:47, 4:110, 11:114, 15, 49 through 50, and on. In Surah 20, verse 82, in 39, verse 33, on. These are examples of many, numerous other citations in the Quran emphasizing that Allah is interested in only in our sincerity and our attempt to correct our path. So from the analysis of those differences, it would appear to me that they are not just, as you mentioned earlier, for example, it's not really a minor type of difference, but as you put it, there are really major and important differences which negate any notion of the Quran being based on the Bible.
Mm-hmm. Well, on the question about sacrifice, some would claim that Muslims too believe in blood sacrifice for forgiveness, and they refer to the practice of sacrificing the animals at the feast of sacrifice. Is that analogy a correct one in your view?
No, in all humbleness, it's not. It's a common one, like the previous notions, but I'm glad that you raised it so that at least you can clarify, because I remember that question being directed to me also by some Christian friends when we had some discussion on the topic. No, it has nothing to do with this. Number one, the sacrifice of animals in the Feast of Sacrifice, or Eid al-Adha, one of the two major Muslim festivals, has nothing to do with the question of forgiveness of original sin, because there is no original sin to start with in Islamic thinking. And the reason, or to give you two evidences that it's not related to the forgiveness in the way it's understood, for example, in the Christian theology, is that, first of all, the sacrifice of these animals is mandatory only on people who are in pilgrimage, who are doing pilgrimage.
Yes.
And forgiveness, as we know, is required for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
So how come it's limited to one group?
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, even for those who are not doing pilgrimage, it's highly commendable, of course, that they do it. But obviously, if a person is poor, he does not have to sacrifice the animal. Again, we know that poor and rich alike lead to atone for their sins. I mean, we can say that one make more sin than the other. They both need it.
Mm-hmm.
So these are two logical reasons why it's not connected with the question of sacrifice. This is just one point. The second aspect is that, according to the Quran, the story of Prophet Abraham and his son Ishmael represented an excellent example and lesson in obedience to God, in submission to Him, and willingness to sacrifice anything upon the command of God. And as the Quran presented that Prophet Abraham received the revelation or directed from God to sacrifice his only son, Ishmael. And I'd like to emphasize here, Ishmael, because not only is that implied from chapter 37 in the Quran, which speaks about the sacrifice story, and then after that, it says that in reward to Abraham, he was giving the glad tidings of another son to be born to him, which is who's Isaac. And of course, this is very essential because it's sometimes puzzling when one reads the book of Genesis when it says that God ordained Abraham to take his only son, Isaac. Isaac was never the only son. The one who was the only son for 14 years was Abraham before Isaac was even born.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, there's a point here so that nobody thinks that it's a typographical error, you know. Mistake. According to the Quran, it was Ishmael. There's no question about it. Logically, it was Ishmael being the only son, even if you take it from the biblical narrative standpoint. But the whole notion is that Abraham took Ishmael to sacrifice him, and in the last minute, God, out of his mercy, having already tested the faith of Abraham, and since Abraham and his son Ishmael showed this submission and willingness to sacrifice, the angel stopped them and he brought a ram to be sacrificed in place of Ishmael. Now, this kind of celebration then, which Muslims do by sacrificing animals in that festival, is basically a commemoration of that act, but not necessarily something that has to do with the forgiveness of sin as such. Another point is that nowhere in the Quran do we find any implication or reference that God or Allah is interested in any blood, whether the blood of animals or humans as such. In fact, it's put beautifully in chapter 22, verse 37. لَنْ يَنَالَ اللَّهَ لُحُومُهَا وَلَا دِمَاؤُهَا وَلَكِنْ يَنَالُهُ التَّقْوَى مِنْكُمْ. That even when you sacrifice this animal, it says, it is not the blood or flesh of this animal that reaches God, but what reaches him is your piety. That's your obedience to him. It's a symbol of obedience rather than anything connected with the mysterious or mystical idea of forgiveness. Another element that many people might not be aware of, which is reflected in the same chapter, chapter 22, is that the sacrifice of animals has another symbolical meaning, and that is the idea of thanksgiving, that this is an occasion where when people slaughter this animal, they thank Allah for whatever animals He made available to them to use or eat. This is mentioned specifically in verse 34 in chapter 22. But there is also, in addition to this, another social and charitable angle or element involved in the sacrifice. And that's also mentioned in the Quran in verse 28, in the same chapter. That's 22. فَكُلُوا مِنْهَا وَأَطْعِمُوا الْبَائِسَ الْفَقِيرِ. Eat you from out of this meat that you sacrifice and feed the poor. So it's a multi-dimensional thing, and none of which really has any connotation whatsoever with the notion of blood sacrifice as a precondition or prerequisite for forgiveness of sins, the way it is understood or was understood by the Jews, for example, or in Christian theology. It has nothing to do with it at all.
Mm-hmm. Well, are there other aspects of belief which relate to this question of the Quran borrowing from the Bible which you wish to highlight or touch on?
Well, there are several. We started first with the three elements, the question of the belief in God, the prophethood, and the concept of sin and atonement, of course, being pillars of any faith, for that matter. Mm-hmm. But in addition, yes, there are numerous other points. Maybe just take a few of them. Mm-hmm. Take the question of belief in the hereafter. There is a common ground also that both Muslims and Jews and Christians, all biblical and Quranic versions, is that there is life hereafter. But that does not necessarily deal with substantial differences. For example, my understanding of the verses in the Bible, both Old and New Testament, that is, the wages of sin, as Paul put it, is death. And as such, the punishment of those who have infractions is that they will not have this eternal life. Mm-hmm. Whereas the Quran indicates clearly that whether the person is good or bad, whether he is quote-unquote saved or not, everybody would resurrect in the day of judgment, everybody would be subjected to judgment, and everybody again would be placed either in the paradise or the hellfire. So the death is not the end of it, regardless of what person is exposed to. The other aspect also that might be related here is that while there is belief in afterlife, the description, at least that as I interpret from the Christian position on that, the major position generally upheld, is that afterlife is mainly spiritual. Mm-hmm. In the Quran, however, we find that it is both spiritual as well as physical, even though the term physical here does not mean the exact similar physical body that we have here on earth, but it is not totally spiritual. There is some elements also of physical life involved, even though, of course, as the Prophet has warned, so that we don't really take some of the descriptions in the Quran in a superficial way and take it literally. When he said that in paradise there are things that no eye has ever seen, no ear has ever heard, and no thought even could have occurred to the mind of any person. So it's something that we don't know, but it is both physical as well as spiritual. The question of salvation also that we discussed, the absence of any notion of original sin, the absence of inheritance of that sin, the absence of the necessity of blood sacrifice, all these points are related quite closely to another important concept in Islam, and that is the lack of intermediary. That is, the belief in Islam is that the relationship between the human and the Creator are primarily direct relationships. So the question of having intermediaries to reach for God or to pray, for example, in the name of someone else, no matter how great that person may be, prophet or otherwise, is absent in Islam. I haven't never seen a Muslim, for example, saying, I pray to God in the name of Muhammad, for example, no matter how great the last prophet of Allah has been.
Yes.
But that is beyond even the question of praying in the name of someone else, not directly to the Creator. It relates also to the notion or concept of quote-unquote church. At least, as you know, in Christian theology, when Jesus said that Peter was the rock on which he is going to build the church, mm-hmm. That has been interpreted to mean that in a way he's like the successor or, you know, someone to mediate or stand between the human and God. The concept of church, as has been interpreted for hundreds of years, is that it is basically an institution that you have to go through. In other words, you have to belong, you have to be a member of a church in order to, you know, reach for God. The idea of priesthood, especially before the Protestant Reformation movement, mm-hmm. still carries a great deal of this sense of intermediary. And this notion does not exist in Islam. There is nothing in Islam like, quote-unquote, a church, an exclusive institution with an ordination type of procedure that nobody else who did not go through that training has any right to speak on religion or teach it. Ideally, every Muslim is quote unquote is a priest unto himself and others. There's no such distinction in the ideas that might have emerged later in Christianity might have been in fact an influence of Islam, because as you know, Protestant Reformation movement came hundreds of years after Islam was already well spread all over the world, and the ideas and the notions of direct human divine relationship has been very much emphasized. And one final point, if I may add also, the orientation towards life in general, that while there may be some legal aspects involved in the Bible, especially in the Torah, we find the Quran is much more comprehensive. It approaches life as an integrated whole, dealing not only with the moral and spiritual aspect of life and acts of worship, but also with the social, political, and economic aspects of life as well. And any fair person who examines both scriptures would not come with the conclusion that many authors hastily put without any verification or evidence that the Quran borrowed from the Bible or any other scripture for that matter.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think on that note, we'll leave it for today. We want to thank you for watching. Invite you back next week, and we'll continue this discussion. Assalamu alaikum. Peace be unto you.